I'm a big fan of writing contracts in plain English. There are terms of art that we need to use in order for it to be, you know, recognized by a court and interpreted properly and all this kind of stuff. But that doesn't mean it has to be just a bunch of gobbledygook words that nobody has used for centuries. It should be in plain English, and you as the player should be able to literally just read it and know what it says.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Approachable. My name is Joe Henderson.
And I'm Paige Pierce. And today, usually we have people that you haven't heard from lately, right? And people that aren't in the spotlight. But our guest today, Chris Clark from discgolf.law, he has been everywhere. There's so many things going on with lawsuits and just all different legal things. But today we wanted to have him on and ask a lot of different questions than people have been asking him. Stuff about trademarks and course design and running leagues and all kinds of different things, as well as expanding on some of the things he's already talked about. So let's go ahead and bring him on. Today we have discgolf.law, what, founder? Chris Clark?
Yes, correct. Founder, yeah.
When did you become a lawyer? And then when did you start Disc Golf Law and realize disc golf needs lawyers?
Yeah, so I have been a lawyer now for 21 and a half years, believe it or not. I can't even believe I'm saying that.
Wow.
I should also talk a little bit maybe into my disc golf journey, how I got to discgolf.law. I picked up the game right around 1991, just as a casual player. And then school, career, family, all these kind of things. I wasn't really serious about it. I took a lot of time away from the game. And my son, Matt, who works with me at the firm, really started getting into it and sort of drew me back into it. And this would have been kind of 2018, 2019 type timeframe where we really started playing a lot again. And that's when I started paying attention to some of the developments in the sport, right? But I mean, I started noticing that athletes were getting bigger sponsorship deals, purses were growing, coverage was getting better, advertisers were coming along, all these kinds of things. And I thought, you know, I've always heard and read that if you can, it's great to make what you are passionate about your job, right? Make that your career.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I have such a love and passion for the sport. And I knew that a lot of the experiences that I had had and a lot of the knowledge that I had, I felt I could contribute in a way to help. I hope this comes across the right way, but I could contribute that in a way to help the sport grow up the way that it was growing up in so many other areas.
Mm-hmm.
And quickly found out that I knew and understood the culture of the sport, I felt. And I knew that, look, a lot of deals are done on a handshake, and that with the dollars growing and getting to be what they were at the time, I just perceived that there was going to be a need for more experienced, more sophisticated legal counsel within the sport. And so that's kind of maybe a long rambling answer to the question that you asked, which is in 2020, my son Matt and I started discgolf.law.
Okay. Wow. I mean, yeah, right away, you know that in 2018, you say you kind of get back into the sport and you already kind of feel, hey, contracts are growing. This might be something that I need to start getting into. 2 years later, you start discgolf.law. And, you know, we've heard from you on other podcasts in the recent months. And you talked a lot about Gannon's contract and Natalie Ryan's lawsuit with the PDGA and DGPT. But Joe and I, we might get there if we have enough time with you, but we have so many other questions pertaining to things that could come up or things that potential up-and-comers or even top-level pros now could or should be thinking about. And I watched your interview on the Nick and Matt show where you said the biggest thing that you see coming in lawsuits would be disc names and how certain companies have competing disc names. Can you elaborate on that? And is there also anything else that you foresee being a future problem?
Yeah, I would even broaden that even beyond disc names to just trademark in general.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't even necessarily have to be disc names. It can be player logos, for example.
Yeah, exactly.
So trademark law is something, it sounds odd to say, but it's something I'm passionate about too. And the reason is, a lot of people don't realize this, but trademark law exists to protect the consumer, right? It's not there to protect the company or the trademark owner. Trademark law, the purpose of it is to protect the consumer. What do I mean by that? Well, what I mean is, if you are someone that is new to the sport, somebody that's new to disc golf, and you're going to go into a disc golf shop, go into your local disc golf shop, and you want it to be clear what the source of these various products are, right? And so if you see, whether it be discs, hoodies, carts, chalk bags, whatever the case may be, that have confusingly similar names to one another, your buddy may have told you, oh, you should try throwing a Wraith. And so you go into the store and you see a disc that's called a Wrath, W-R-A-T-H, mm-hmm. which is an actual mold of a disc. It would be easy for someone who is new to the game to be confused and actually accidentally get the wrong thing.
Absolutely.
And similarly, you know, your buddy's wearing a hoodie with a player's logo on it. You may go down to your local shop. You want to get that same kind of thing, and you see a confusingly similar logo. And now you were trying to support the player that you thought you were supporting, but you've bought somebody else. So I just, my experience in other industries, it is typical that companies and individuals do at least some basic trademark planning, some basic trademark strategy in that way. And we just haven't seen that yet in our sport. And that's why, hope I'm wrong, but that's why I fear that at some point we may have some disputes around those logos and those brands.
Right.
Okay.
How would you go about setting yourself up for success in trademark law then? Like, what could players do to ensure that that doesn't happen?
There's a couple things you can do. I think as best we can, not just in disc golf, but in all sports and all lines of business, you know, you want to strive for something unique. It's funny, I'll never forget this. This was probably, gosh, 10 years ago, but I had a client say to me, you know, look, we're just going to name all of our products some undecipherable jumble of letters because everything else is taken, you know? and so I understand it can be frustrating trying to, especially if you fall in love with the name or with the logo, it can be frustrating to be told, look, you really got to choose something else. And I get that. But we have available on request, you can email info@discgolf.law. I'll be happy to send this out. We actually have a step-by-step do-it-yourself trademark search document that we can send out to people. It's not a replacement for having a qualified trademark lawyer do a search. What a trademark lawyer can do with a search, especially in analyzing the results, is far deeper and broader than what this document does. But this is a good start, and it can help people like start off on a good foot to know, hey, is this trademark that I'm choosing going to create a problem for me or not?
Interesting. Well, that's super helpful. Everybody should go check that out. That's like,
absolutely.
Wow. It's awesome.
Well, I think it's consistent with the theme of the podcast, right? That we're trying to make this approachable for people. And so that's why I thought it was really interesting. I don't know if it was intentional or not, but the subject that you started with, asking about trademarks, it really is there to protect the consumer. And in many cases, the consumer that we're thinking about in our sport are these people that are new that we're trying to draw in to the game. And so I think that aligns really nicely.
Yeah, I mean, we can always talk about what's currently going on, but it's also, I feel like we're in a good position to set ourselves up for success in the future, kind of how Joe phrased that prior question, right? And another thing that has happened to me actually in the past, but also I fear could happen again, and personal advice, I would love to hear you talk about like image and likeness, right? So when we, as a pro tour player, we sign up for the pro tour, we get a tour card, we are one of the top 20 in the world, and we sign off saying you can use our image and likeness. What are the individual's rights, and how do you go about obviously am going to sign that piece of paper because I want to play in those tournaments. But do I have negotiating power? And yeah, can you just give someone an advice in that whole topic?
Boy, that is a great question. And it is such a complicated area to try to understand and answer, especially because the laws in the United States around the use of a person's image and likeness are somewhat different from a lot of other countries in the world. In the US, unfortunately, or however you may look at it, it's a little more difficult to protect and enforce your rights around your name and likeness. But there's a few things that I would say. Number one, it's pretty much universal in every state that I'm aware of. You can't make false statements about someone and communicate that to third parties that would tend to reflect negatively on their profession. And so regardless of what rights you may have agreed to when you sign that contract, there are limits to it. That's an area of law called defamation that you've probably heard of before. Mm-hmm. That's one thing. You know, there is a limit to what people can do when you grant them the right to use your name and likeness.
What if it's not defamation? What if, so a real life example, when I was sponsored by Dynamic Discs, they have a partnership with Zuka, the cart company. So we all know the triple Mandos that are like the Zuka banners, right? So I am not sponsored by Zuka in any way. And my photo along with their company and everything was on the Zuka banner. And I was like, huh, I haven't received any compensation for that. I didn't, not even compensation. I didn't agree to that, sign anything. And it wasn't defamation by any means. It was actually kind of cool. You know, I'm now on a 6-foot billboard, but nonetheless, it was like, how did this happen? And what do I do about it? So besides defamation, do you think that's something that I should have spoken up about? Which I did, but do you think, I mean, in hindsight now, was that good of me to speak up about that? Or should I have just been like, hey, cool, that's a nice free billboard. Thank you.
It's a tough question to answer because so much of it is situation dependent. And the answer that I give to Paige Pierce might be different if it were a different player.
Okay.
It might be different if it were a company other than Zuka. It's very situation dependent, but I think the example that you just gave really succinctly illustrated one of the points that I tried to make right at the beginning of this podcast, which is the culture of our sport has traditionally been just go along to get along, right?
Right.
And so somebody takes Paige's picture and throws it up on this big, you know, Zuka ad. And I think the expectation traditionally has just been, oh, you know, it's all good. Everybody's good with that. And then you get people coming along who are saying, no, this is my career. This is my image. This is my brand. I take it so seriously. And I didn't authorize this use. And so I'm going to say something about it. And that's a great illustration of why I think we do need to spend a little more time on these contracts. Sponsorship contracts, whatever the case may be, the really just contracts in general in our sport, not because I love the idea of people getting in disputes and going to court and suing each other and stuff like that. In fact, the opposite is true. I'm quite conflict averse. I prefer to work on deals, people kind of all working towards the same goal. But the example that you just gave, I think shows that now the stakes are high enough that we do need to, you know, pay close attention to things like what contracts say and what exact rights we've given away and what rights we haven't.
And so do you think that that is a one more real life example leading into my next question? So I'm sure all three of us follow the Disc Golf Pro Tour on Instagram, correct?
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yep.
So I would say up to 5, 10, 15 times I've seen the Disc Golf Pro Tour post like a slider reel of something from one of their partners. Maybe it would be Sunstein or, you know, doesn't matter, but one of the companies that they partner with. Now, the photo in said slider might be Chris Clements, Sarah Hokum, Katrina Allen. The players in the photos don't partner with that company, but the Pro Tour does. So that company is getting action shots of dominating players and likable players, which they didn't pay the player for, but the player signed the Disc Golf Pro Tour contract. What does the player do in that situation? I think that this is for the pro players currently, but also for all of our listeners that are aspiring to become pro, to go on the tour. What do they need to be thinking about when they're, should they sign that pro tour contract, or should they get a lawyer to kind of make some addendums to the contract?
You know, I think it's going to sound self-serving, but I think it's always a good idea to at least have a lawyer look over the contract, especially if you have questions about it. In a situation like the one you described, Paige, is it likely that a new player on the Pro Tour is going to be able to get the Pro Tour to modify the agreement that presumably most, if not all, the other players on the tour have signed? Probably not. I think it's a good idea for the player to read it carefully, come up with questions, take that to a lawyer, have them look at it and explain it. And then you've got to weigh the pros and cons, right? Look, I want so badly to be a player on the Disc Golf Pro Tour. Maybe I'm willing to agree to certain things that I may not otherwise be willing to agree to just because I want to have that opportunity. But again, as we continue to grow up and start taking things like this more seriously, I don't see any harm in a player or a player's representative, whether that's a lawyer or an agent or something like that, asking the Pro Tour, hey, would you consider modifying this provision in this contract? We've got a concern. Here it is. And I think the first time somebody asks them that, they will probably be incredulous and say, no, everybody else signs that. The third person, the fifth person, the seventh person with that same question or concern, it may over time be something that the Pro Tour would consider changing for all their agreements. So long answer way of saying, Paige, yes, I do think that it is good for the player to raise their concerns when they see something like that in a contract.
Yeah. Wow.
That's a lot.
I have about 40 questions right now, so I'm just going to give Joe a second.
Sounds good. You bet. I can take it away. So we've been talking a lot about contracts and all of that kind of thing, but how do you build a contract? Like, how do you start from point zero? What do you do with that?
So there's some pretty basic things, and believe it or not, I don't mean to pick on disc golf because I've seen this in other industries too, but even just some of these very basic things that I'm about to list frequently get overlooked. So for example, let's make sure that the parties to the contract are correctly identified. And so a player, it's not too tough. I mean, they have a name, right? And so you want to just put their name in there. We usually want to have their address. You know, my hunch is that somewhere else in the world, there's somebody else named Paige Pierce. So, you know, just put the person
who is also
name
a world champion, funny enough.
In there's what? I'm curious.
Archery. There's a Paige Pierce who's a world champion in archery.
Fascinating. Yeah. Okay. Well, cool. something like the effective date of the contract. You know, when does this contract take effect? That really is more important for determining exactly the term of the contract, like when it starts, more importantly, in some cases, when it ends, right? But a lot of times there'll be a space right at the top of the contract where it says effective date and it'll just be blank. I mean, I've seen that dozens of times. We want it to be really clear about what each side to the contract is promising to do. That goes to the enforceability of the contract, because if it's one-sided, in other words, if only one party is obligated to do something and the other party isn't, that's a non-enforceable contract. There has to be give and take on both sides. And so just making sure that that part of it is there too. The final thing I would say, and I think this is probably especially true for players, maybe more so than companies, you should be able to know and understand exactly what your contract says. If there's language in there, the hereby, heretofore, whereas kind of stuff.
Get a lawyer.
Yeah. And get a lawyer that can change that. You know, you I'm a big fan of writing contracts in plain English. There are terms of art that we need to use in order for it to be, you know, recognized by a court and interpreted properly and all this kind of stuff. But that doesn't mean it has to be just a bunch of gobbledygook words that mm-hmm. nobody has used for centuries. Mm-hmm. It should be in plain English, and you as the player should be able to literally just read it and know what it says.
Mm-hmm. So with, you say that the player should have a lawyer to go to the Pro Tour and say, hey, I don't know, can you revise that? Building on that, do you think that there's any benefit to having a players union with a designated lawyer who says it's not individual based, right? It's like, hey, I'm representing this group of players and they will not sign this Pro Tour contract or PDJ contract unless these things are clarified or reworded somehow.
So I'll say two things about that. One, I could certainly see the benefit of that. And all we need to do is look to other sports, right?
Almost every other sport. Yeah.
Exactly. And so, you know, whether a person might be pro union or not pro union in general, I think if you look at other professional sports, you can easily see the benefit. Somehow the NFL has a players union and it has survived and thrived. So mm-hmm. I don't buy the argument that a players union in disc golf would kill the sport or something like that. So I certainly can see the benefit of that. But my second comment would be, it certainly doesn't have to be either or. You can be a player. You can be a member of a players union. Your players union can have a lawyer that advocates on behalf of the members of the union, but you can also have your own individual lawyer. And, you know, I think, again, looking at other sports, that's certainly the case in many other sports. There are going to always be times when you as a player, your interests are aligned with the other players in the sport as a whole. But mm-hmm. there will inevitably be times where your individual interests aren't completely aligned with them. And so you should have an advocate for yourself as well, in my opinion.
Yeah. And something that you said on a Nick and Matt show interview that really hit home with me and I was like fist pumping at the screen was that every contract should be individual, right? Mm, like we
sure.
shouldn't just have a star team contract or a elite team contract. Each contract is different. And Joe and I have talked about this on even in season one, you know, that each player brings to the table something different. And so that sponsor should treat that relationship differently, right? With that being said, how do you suggest that a player negotiates, say it's not a world champion, not someone with a lot of bargaining power. Say it's someone who is fresh off a hot season. People know them, but they're not like the top of the top. And they are thinking about switching sponsors. How would you advise them to negotiate a contract with a new company where they have power and they have individualism, but even throughout not being the top of the top?
I think it is in the player's interest to customize each contract for their unique situation while keeping in mind it's likely in the sponsor's interest to keep contracts as similar as possible one to the next. And I'm not putting a value judgment on either one. I don't think either one is right or wrong. I think there's good reasons on each side for both. But regarding the question you asked, I think if I were that player that you're describing, I would try to keep two things in mind. Number one, if I'm going to ask my sponsor or my potential sponsor to change something in their contract, I need to be able to explain why, for me, that provision doesn't work or that provision needs to be changed. You know, a lot of times we'll see lawyers or parties to a contract will get a copy of the contract and they'll mark it up and they'll make changes, but it's not clear why they're asking for what they're asking for. And in my experience, reasonable parties can understand each other when there is something that, you know, for that particular party, this may work for everybody else, but it doesn't work for me. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing I would try to keep in mind is think in terms of give and take. Maybe it's standard for this particular sponsor to pay their team of players $4 for each Signature Series disc that they sell from their website. I'm just making these numbers up out off the top of my head. So that's their standard, and that's what's in the contract. Well, if you think as a player you're entitled to $5 instead of $4, look for something else in the contract that's maybe not as important to you, mm-hmm. and say to your sponsor, hey, what if I give on this provision? What if I say, I'm going to make this part of the contract more favorable for you, sponsor, and in exchange, I want you to make this royalty or dollar amount or whatever the case may be more favorable to me. So I would just try to be thinking in those terms. Mm-hmm. I think just going to the sponsor and making a bunch of demands without any real reasoning behind it and without being willing to maybe give on another point probably is less likely to work.
And I know we've been seeing a little bit of a break in contract or anything like that, like with Ricky and Innova and Gannon and Prodigy, we're still working out that deal. But has there been any other sports that have breaks in contracts? And like, is there a history of that in other sports?
Yes. And I know you're asking specifically about sports. And yeah. So I would say yes, but contracts are broken every day.
Every day, it's routine.
Yeah, it's routine. And I would urge people maybe not to think of that as necessarily a bad thing, at least not always. I think a lot of people have the view that, oh, you signed a contract, you promised to do something. So if you break it, you're breaking your promise and you're a bad person. Really, my mindset around how contracts work is you've entered into this contract with another party, you've promised to do something. And if you don't do it, whether you just can't do it or whether you choose not to do it for whatever the reason is, there are consequences associated with that. Mm-hmm. To use the example that you just raised of Gannon's contract, you know, I don't know anything about the terms of Gannon's contract other than, you know, what we saw in the lawsuit documents, but a bunch of the stuff was blacked out, right? But let's just say that if Gannon has just the most amazing year and he sells a ton of Gannon Bird discs, that he stands to make $80,000 under a particular contract. Let's say the Prodigy contract, he stands to make that. If another sponsor comes along and offers him four times that, then of course I'm going to break that contract. I will take whatever the consequences are of breaking the first contract because the upside of the other contract is so huge. And so that's just to say, let's try not to interpret every breach or break or termination of a contract as necessarily something that's bad. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And to advocate for the players, myself included, you know, I've broken two contracts now. You guys know that I have broken them. You know that Gannon's broke it. You know that Ricky's broke it. But you don't know that the counterpart also broke it. So when that news breaks, it seems like that player is in the wrong, but really the full scope isn't out there, you know. And exactly, you said that same thing on another podcast where you now going to this new company, you have enough money to, if it comes to it, pay the other company off and say, hey, look, let's amicably part ways. Here's the money that I would have owed you, or vice versa, and let's just move on. Now, one thing that you did touch on that I wanted to ask further questions on were, say player A breaks a contract and company A doesn't say or do anything about it. Now, a year down the line, they could choose to do that. You said that there's no time limit on when a company could do that. This is really hypothetical, but say Prodigy decided this wasn't a big deal, Gannon, go ahead and part ways. But 2025 rolls around and Prodigy goes bankrupt and they say, you know what, let's sue Gannon for when he broke the contract years ago. Is that realistic to think about? And there's absolutely no time limit on that?
Yeah, it doesn't work quite like that.
Okay.
There's a couple of things that would make the hypothetical that you just gave a little bit different than the situation I was talking about. So let me tell you what those are. First of all, there are, for most civil causes of action that you would have against another party, there are statutes of limitations. And so,
can you, for layman's terms, what is the statute of limitations?
It just means that if you have some type of civil cause of action, and when I say civil cause of action, I'm just talking about, it's not criminal. I'm not talking about somebody committed a crime. I'm talking about something like a breach of a contract.
Okay.
Or somebody, say somebody injures you, somebody, you know, hits you with their car, something like that. You can't just wait 20 years and then decide that you want to sue them. It doesn't work that way. What a statute of limitations is it says, hey, if you're going to bring this type of action, so let's just say breach of contract, if you're going to bring a breach of contract action, you have X number of years to do it. And it's different in various states. It's often 3 years or 4 years or something like that. And the reason for that is obvious and simple. It's because the more time goes by, you kind of have, you know, people's memories get foggy, evidence maybe gets destroyed, things mm-hmm. like that. And so it's sort of in the public's interest to make sure that if one of these claims does arise, you take action on it within a certain amount of time. But the situation that I was talking about was within the context of an active contract. And so what I was saying, and I'm trying to think of, okay, so we're giving Gannon a lot of attention tonight.
I know.
Let's just say Gannon is still a Prodigy player, and his contract requires him to wear Prodigy apparel whenever he competes in an Elite Series event, something mm-hmm. like that. Let's just say it says that. So Gannon shows up to a tournament and he doesn't have any Prodigy apparel on. Well, that's a breach of the contract, but Prodigy chooses, hey, we're not going to say anything about it. Mm-hmm. Next tournament, same thing. No Prodigy apparel. Next tournament, same thing. Next tournament, the same thing. He's still under contract with Prodigy. The contract hasn't ended. Mm-hmm. You know, there's still a contract. Well, the fifth or sixth time that he either forgets or chooses not to wear Prodigy apparel, Prodigy comes along and says, hey, Gannon, it says right here in your contract, you got to wear Prodigy apparel. We expect you to do that. Next tournament, you better have Prodigy apparel on, or we're going to hold you in breach of this contract. Gannon can't say, well, you didn't say anything the first time, five times that I did it. You can't say that now. In most cases, there's a little bit of nuance to it, but in most cases, that's not going to be a defense. You know, Gannon doesn't have that defense. And in most contracts, most types of commercial contracts, at least the ones that we work on, we actually put that provision in there that says, you know, hey, just because one side may let the other side get away with a breach a few times, it doesn't mean that they don't have the right to then call mm-hmm. them out that fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh time, whatever, maybe.
Interesting.
Very interesting. Is this like a service that you would take care of for players on tour? And what other kinds of services would you take care of for the players on tour?
You know, contracts is probably number one. Contracts make the world go round. And if there is any type of a commercial or professional or business relationship that involves a meaningful amount of money or potentially involves a meaningful amount of money, I think it's in everyone's best interest to have a properly drafted contract for it. So that's the main thing. This intellectual property protection, mainly trademark, but also potentially could be copyright, could be patent, could be trade secrets. These are all things that we're doing on a weekly basis for clients.
Yes.
And that's awesome. It's been interesting because I would say the one thing that has surprised me the most since we started focusing our practice, our law practice on disc golf, is the amount of entrepreneurship that is going on in our sport right now. And I'm talking, some are very sophisticated and well-funded, and some are, you know, people that are just, they got a dream and they're starting something in the garage on their weekend. Mm-hmm. You know, helping those people maybe get a company set up, maybe bring an investor in, maybe if things really go well, get into some kind of strategic partnership with another company, you know, where they can work together to bring some kind of innovative new disc golf product or service to market. That's sort of a high level overview of the types of services we provide.
Just to kind of like digest that a little bit more, what is the difference between a patent, copyright, and was there another one that you said?
Yeah, and trademark. And trademark,
yeah.
I even threw a fourth one in there, which is trade secrets, but right. I'll set that one aside because I think that's probably the one that we do the least with. This is also another set, like you can go to seminars and spend 2 days talking about, you know, the differences between different types of intellectual property protection. But look, patents protect inventions. For example, we've got a lot of people that frankly are just inventing things, either brand new things or inventing improvements to things that already exist in our sport. If your invention meets certain qualifications, it might be eligible to have patent protection. And that would mean that you're able to exclude others from making this invention that you have created. Mm-hmm. So that's patent. Trademark, it protects, people typically say brands. I don't want to get too deep into the legalese, but really what trademark protects is a source identifier. What I mean by that is when you walk into a store and you see a product that says Discraft on it, you know something about where that product came mm-hmm. from. Okay. Like, so that's the type of protection, protecting the goodwill that you've developed around that brand. That's what trademark is all about. And then copyright, it protects what we call in the law works of authorship. And that's got a broader definition than it might sound like. So when you hear authorship, you think writings. Well, yes, I mean, books for sure, but also musical compositions, sound recordings, even things like designs, architectural works. There's a range of things that fall within that definition mm-hmm. of works of authorship. That's what copyright is all about. So for us, we feel like if you are in business, and disc golf is a business, we all know that. If you are in business and you're conducting business under a brand, it's worth getting some protection around that. So that's why we've really been hammering trademark more so than these other forms of intellectual property protection.
This podcast is brought to you by Grip Equipment, the world's leading disc golf bag company. Since 2009, they've been at the forefront of creating the world's most comfortable, durable, and innovative bags on the market. Check out their wide variety of bags at grip-eq.com. If you need a backpack-style bag, you can swing on any one of Grip Equipment's models and immediately feel the back padding and shoulder strap comfort that will keep your mind on the course, not having to worry about your bag or your back. The bottom footrails and side panel construction work together to keep your bag upright to prevent leaning. The last thing that you want to do on the course is to have to clean up your entire disc selection that's just fallen into the mud. Join the thousands of disc golfers who have trusted Grip EQ bags for over a decade. Head over to grip-eq.com and take your game to the next level.
So something on that trademark, I think this would fall into the trademark, is so the first example that I saw that was like glaringly obvious. So Dynamic Disc had this Trooper bag and they made it a very low price point. So anyone could buy it. I think it was like $40 or something. And then we saw MVP release the almost identical bag, except it says MVP on it. And then fast forward, Pound Bags, now Squatch is like the same thing. And then Prodigy did this and it's like the same bag. Now, is it similar to in music where somebody can remix a song and a certain percentage of the song has to be different? Is it similar to that where, you know, like imitation is the biggest form of flattery, right? And it's like Dynamic or Pound Bags has to be like, well, I guess we made a good bag, right? But should they go after that? Should they just be flattered by it? And what does the MVP or the Squatch bag required to do to just change it a tiny bit?
So I was a music major in college. I started my career actually in the music industry working at a record label. So let me relieve you of your incorrect understanding that with the remix, a certain percentage has to be different. That's not the test.
Okay.
And it's not the test for disc golf bags either. So it is difficult. One thing that Dynamic could have done or Pound could have done is try to seek some type of copyright protection for the designs of their bag. And when I'm saying designs, I'm not talking about just how the bag looks. I'm talking about like what's on the paper that they give to the factory or the CAD files or whatever in order to actually make that bag. And if they had copyright protection on those designs, then if anyone copied those designs, then they would have a cause of action against them. They would have a claim against them. And I think it's highly unlikely that any of the disc golf bag makers did that. Mm-hmm. So the question you asked is essentially, what kind of protection can someone who manufactures and sells a bag have when somebody manufactures and sells a bag that looks nearly identical to it? And it's very difficult. It's really difficult to protect your creation in that way.
Unless you patent a certain like zipper method or something like that.
So there's a type of patent called a design patent. It sort of does what the name implies. It protects the design or visual elements of this invention. So there's something that perhaps someone could have done along those lines. So yes, you're right. There may have been a potential for patent protection there. There may have even been a potential for utility patent protection, which is the most common type of patent. If the bag really did something new and unique that no bag had ever done, and they'd taken the trouble to go and get a patent on that, then yes, then there would be a strong claim against this other company. But let me just, again, you know, challenge the mindset a little bit. If company A makes a nice looking bag that's high quality and a lot of people love it, and company B can come along and make a very similar bag, but it costs $100 less, we want that, right? I mean, mm-hmm. that's good for the consumers. Mm-hmm. And so not so good for company A, and my heart goes out to them, and you know, it, that just is what it is. But I think one reason that we don't have legal protections in place to prevent that is it actually turns out in some ways to be good for the consumer.
Okay. Since you kind of started to get to that, right, where the consumer is benefiting, that's more so what this show is about, right? It's not about the touring pro that's trying to build a contract or someone that's trying to trademark something. It's the people that are playing the weekly rounds, and maybe they're playing in tournaments 2, 4, 5 times a year, but they're not on tour. So can you speak to those people, and what should they think about when they're thinking about maybe getting a lawyer involved? Maybe these people at home they have a product that they swear by, an accessory, a new company, and they're thinking about putting their foot in the door into the disc golf market. What should they be thinking about besides all of these contracts and trademarks and stuff like that?
It's interesting the wide range of people that reach out to us. We've had a couple of folks that, you know, hey, the TD at my local C tier excluded me from the tournament unfairly. What can I do? You know, that kind
really?
Of thing. So
wow.
I'm not suggesting that every time you get in an argument with your local TD that you need to call your lawyer, but yeah. It's surprised even me the amount of times that the people we're hearing from are not always the manufacturers or big sponsors or professional players, but you know, it is other people, you know, just kind of regular people that enjoy playing the sport. So I would say it may sound odd coming from somebody who makes their living the way I do, but I'm really not someone that feels like, you know, every little thing that happens, you need to call your lawyer. I don't think that if you are a casual player and you're falling in love with the sport and you're trying to get better, don't spend too much time thinking about legal issues in disc golf, frankly.
Yeah.
Get out in the field and work on your drive. Exactly. Or get the basket in the backyard and practice your putt and use your energy towards that. There's always a role for good counsel, whether it's in disc golf or other things. But I don't want to try to insert myself too much into situations where really, frankly, legal services aren't needed.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
There is something I just thought of with the PDGA. When you sign up for a tournament, whether that be a C tier, B tier, A tier, NT, major, each of those progressively get more benefits, right? More insurance dollars.
Added cash, all that stuff.
Yeah, but mostly why a tournament director, I've been told, wants to get a PDGA sanctioning is because it comes along with insurance. So if somebody gets hurt at that tournament, the PDGA insurance policy covers that. So if there is someone that's throwing a weekly or that's not sanctioned or a backyard tournament and they get hurt, do you have anything that you would suggest towards those people and just overall people that own a course that someone might get hurt at that course?
Yeah. Okay. So let me take those separately. I think if you own a course, which, you know, I'm fortunate to live here in Charlotte, and there are a number of private courses around here. If you own a course, I do think it's probably a good idea to have some general liability insurance in place. I don't think it's terribly expensive. I'm not an insurance expert, so an insurance agent could probably speak to that more eloquently than I can. It's a great question about the unsanctioned weekly league. It's not a PGA sanctioned thing. I mean, we have those all the time here in Charlotte. We every night of the week during the summer, if you want to play in a league, you can.
Yeah, I believe it.
And so I would say if you're a player and you choose to play in these leagues and you fall down the hill and sprain your ankle or injure yourself or something like that, maybe don't think so much about going and, you know, trying to sue the TV or, you know, make some kind of trouble. Maybe think, you know, hey, I chose to play a sport where you go up and down hills in the woods and things like that.
You would think that, but what about the person that sued McDonald's for the coffee being too hot?
It's right. There's always one, like it's coffee.
Yeah. Come on.
You expect it to be hot. You should expect that.
And I would like to think that disc golfers were more cool than that, but you know, you never know.
I would hope so. And you never know. And it only takes one, right? You know, you may have 99 cool people in your league and one person that's just looking to sue somebody, I guess. Yeah. But serious answer for the person running the league, I'm not going to get too specific here, but there are certain elements that need to be met in order to successfully bring a legal claim against somebody. Think about the issue of causation, right? How do we impose liability for me falling down the hill and spraining my ankle on the TD? Are there arguments you could make? Probably. I'm sure it is something that comes up from time to time, but you know, I guess other than maybe getting an insurance policy, maybe advising the TD to get insurance, I guess I don't really have a real good answer to that.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's fair.
That's the first time I've heard you say that. So, you know, well I'm happy that we stumped you.
I'll be the first to admit that not just with legal topics, but lots of things in life, there's way more I don't know than what I do know. But thankfully, so far, you guys, the questions have been sort of right in my wheelhouse so far.
Nice. We've crafted them up beautifully. Let's see if this one here is just like that. I'm just wondering about building courses like Paige said, but is there anything that anyone needs to know? I know like a lot of courses are on city property and there's a lot of crown land. That's what it's called in Canada. I don't know if it's any different in the States, but we call it crown land where it's like kind of like untouched land basically and no one owns it. Is there anything you'd need to know about that?
We do represent some course designers, and so we've looked at this a little bit. I think you got to go a long way to impose some type of liability on a course designer for some type of injury or liability that would arise someone playing on the course. And I think especially in the cases of municipal courses that are in parks and things like that, if there is some type of a dangerous condition out there on the course and the municipality knew about it, but continued to permit people to play, then you may have some type of claim against the municipality. Here in the US, we also have something called sovereign immunity, but makes it a little difficult to sue government entities in certain situations. As a course designer, being too terribly worried about the legal implications of what type of design elements you include in your course, I don't think there's a terribly high risk there in my experience.
That's good to know.
But I understand what Joe's asking because like the memorial, there's like the entire course has sidewalk around it. And so there's humans everywhere and they're unaware. Yeah. Pedestrians and humans. And, you know, same thing for, you know, Austin. We luckily in 2023, we actually have a pro tour in the city limits of Austin, but Austin, Texas has been a city that has infamously not allowed big tournaments because there's so many humans, pedestrians walking around. And yeah, I understand her question because it's like there has to be some sort of liability for just the course even existing there and the city safety, approving it to be there.
Mm-hmm. Well, the unfortunate truth in our country is typically the party that gets sued, the party that's the target of a lawsuit, ends up being the party with the deepest pockets. Mm-hmm. And so Memorial, a perfect example, I'm out walking my dog and I get, you know, Paige rips a drive and it just gashes me right in the side of the head. I could go after Paige, or could I potentially go after the municipality that owns that park or the entity that owns that park. Who's got the biggest insurance policy? That's probably who I'm gonna target. That's just unfortunately the way that litigation works here. I don't mean to make light of being proactive about addressing potential liabilities, because a phrase that we use in our law firm all the time is that we are on a mission to help our clients avoid costly mistakes. Mm-hmm. Avoiding mistakes is way cheaper than having to deal with them afterwards. So, you know, if we can help clients avoid costly mistakes, get that trademark registration so that you're not in a trademark lawsuit years down the road and having this huge expensive headache that you have to deal with. You know, I do think that trying to prevent liabilities or at least be prepared for them is the right thing to do. I don't know that there's a lot of real good legal strategy to avoid, you know, getting hit by an errant drive at a course.
Yeah, for sure. Something you just said about targeting the person who has the deepest pockets. I can't help but think back to your recent interviews and that about Natalie Ryan and Gannon Burr's situations. In the Gannon Burr versus Prodigy situation, where Prodigy obviously has a lot more to lose than Gannon, right? In my opinion. And also Gannon being a minor and his mom co-signing the deal. Say Prodigy wins, who actually has to pay for that? Is it Gannon or is it his mom? And if Gannon and or his mom do not have enough money, what happens with that? Does Prodigy just kind of like a car payment where he just pays as much as he can at a time? Or how does that exactly work? And then in the Natalie Ryan situation, is she specifically choosing to target the PDJ and the DGPT because they have deeper pockets?
I think Natalie's situation is drastically different than Gannon's. It goes without saying it. You know, Gannon's dispute with Prodigy is essentially a financial dispute, period.
Yeah.
Are there other little elements to it? Yes. But really, that is a financial dispute. In Natalie's case, I don't see finances being her primary motivation at all. Certainly it's an element of her claims, but no, I don't think she chose the defendants in that lawsuit because they have money. I think those defendants were named because they're the ones that can take action to address her grievances. Mm-hmm. So maybe the statement I made earlier was a little bit too broad about saying the way litigation works is you always sue whoever has the deepest pockets. I'm really talking about when you're seeking primarily monetary damages, that's the case. You know, Natalie's situation is so complicated, and it drives me bonkers when I see online people saying, oh, I don't see why this is an issue. It should be simple. It's not. It's the furthest thing in the world from simple. And all you have to do is just kind of with an open mind, do some research and analysis into the issues around it. And you'll see that. And so I think she's got a much more complicated, nuanced battle to fight than the Gannon versus Prodigy situation.
Yeah, especially because, I mean, in your last interview, you talked about how it's in the state of California, and you gave a few different options of remedies. And, you know, should we just cancel the OTB Open? Should we not have anything in California? I mean, obviously, she had great legal advice in saying, hey, California says this, this, and this, and you have something to stand on here. So obviously, she knew what she was doing. But if the PDJ and DGPT together decided to cancel the OTB Open, would she still have a leg to stand on? Or does that pretty much eradicate the entire problem?
Yeah, that is a great question. Let me first agree with something that you said. And I said this on Monday, my most recent appearance on the Nick and Matt show, when I said, I do think that her lawyer did a great job with that complaint. I think it's well-written. It's well-argued. I think they found the right claims to make and the right statute to rely on and those sorts of things. I do stand by what I said, which was, I think California is the venue that gives her the highest chance of success. I still think she has an uphill battle to fight. A lot of people, myself included, we've read, obviously, the court documents that were filed in that lawsuit. What we haven't seen yet, at least as of the time that we're recording this, what we haven't seen yet is the response from any of the defendants. And I think you're going to see some very persuasive arguments made on that side too, assuming that they file an answer and it doesn't settle before that. I have a few times said that if the Pro Tour just would cancel the OTB Open, that the currently filed lawsuit, the California lawsuit, would likely go away. And I stand by that. I did get maybe called out a little bit on Twitter by Natalie's lawyer, who said, hey, maybe you don't realize this, but there are similar statutes in other states.
Yeah.
And he didn't really come out and say this, but I assume what he was getting at is, if that were to happen and the California lawsuit goes away, it's not that Natalie's dead in the water, because there are other venues that she could perhaps bring similar claims in. But first, let me say, I didn't know anything about the California Civil Rights Act until I read her complaint, and then I had to go and read the statute. I don't know anything about these statutes in these other states, but even not knowing what I don't know, I still stand by the statement that I do think California gives her the best chance of success. I do think it is still going to be a really tough fight. As regrettable as many aspects of that situation are, I have to confess, I'm very interested to see how this plays out. I mean, for a lawyer that loves disc golf, this is about as good as it gets, you know?
I mean, me too. I have 100 other thoughts based on that. It's like, okay, real estate, for example, we didn't know where we were going to move, right? And when we were looking in Asheville, North Carolina, and then we were like, where do we want to move to Florida? Maggie was our real estate agent. Maggie, can you find us a house in Pensacola? She's like, oh no, honey. It's like, I'm a North Carolina real estate agent. Is it similar in lawyer world? Like, is he, so then I'm assuming Natalie Ryan's lawyer is a California lawyer. And so if this falls through, is she going to find another lawyer in another state? Or are you, in disc golf law, are you, I don't know the proper word, but like qualified to conduct law in other states?
So the short answer is no, but let me tell you what the specifics of that are. So I am licensed to practice in North Carolina. It means I sat for the bar exam here in North Carolina, and the Board of Law Examiners here in North Carolina said, okay, you're fit to practice law here. And so you have a North Carolina law license. What that means is there are a variety of legal tasks that I can do in North Carolina, but that I can't do in other states, at least not without the permission of the court in that state. And so I don't know what states Natalie's lawyer is licensed in. He's obviously licensed in California, because one of those things that I was talking about you have to have a license to do is file a lawsuit in a particular state.
Mm-hmm.
Now, our law firm has clients all over the United States, and that works a few different ways. The ethical rules that apply to lawyers address this issue. And so I'll tell you how I interpret those rules and how we conduct ourselves relative to that. We don't file lawsuits in any state other than North Carolina, and we don't do other types of things like real estate closings in any state other than North Carolina. And so those types of things. What we do, on the other hand, is we form companies in a variety of states. We write and revise and negotiate and consult with clients on contracts that are interpreted under the laws of other states and other things as well. And we file trademark applications and copyright applications on behalf of clients in other states. The way it works is, with respect to the copyright and trademark applications, that's federally based practice. So it's not really tied to any particular state. Mm. But relative to the other things that I mentioned, our ethical requirement is that we have to educate ourselves to the point that we know and understand the law of that jurisdiction well enough to be able to competently advise our clients on that. And for us, we often don't stop there. We've got a network of contacts and lawyers that are licensed in nearly every state in the United States. And so we always have somebody where we can say, hey, we just did this huge contract. It's interpreted under New York law. We're not licensed in New York. Will you just look through it and make sure there's nothing unique about New York law that we missed? So let's bring that back around to Natalie's situation. If she loves the lawyer that she has and she thinks that the lawyer she has did a great job, there would be nothing preventing that lawyer from continuing to advise her and help her work on her case if it were to be filed in another state. He would have to either do what I just described and associate local counsel in that state that has a license in that state and work through that lawyer to file the lawsuit, or he would have to get permission from the court in that state for him to do it himself.
Okay.
Right. And then with the Gannon versus Prodigy, like Gannon is from Iowa and Prodigy is out of Georgia. Is that correct? I think so.
That's correct.
Is that good for their case or is that beneficial or how does that work like for those two?
Yeah. So earlier you guys were asking about, you know, what are some basic contract provisions that people should look out for? And one of them is, you know, what state's law is going to apply to govern this contract? Yeah. And in what state are disputes to be resolved if they arise under the contract? Uh-huh. And in every well-drafted contract that I've ever seen in my life, those are spelled out right there in the contract. And so is it to Prodigy's advantage to kind of have that home field advantage there in the state where they're located? Yes. And that's why they put that in there.
Is that why they set up their business there? Because Michael, the owner or prior owner, he's not from Georgia at all. So is that part of his business plan? Is like, hey, Georgia's got some real sick laws. Let's do that. You know,
I doubt
like,
it.
That's one of the reasons I moved to Florida, you know,
yeah. Right.
Income tax. I'm like, hell yeah, I'm going to go to Florida. So like yeah. When creating a company in this instance, yes, we're talking about Prodigy. Is that something you're thinking about? And when you're filing a lawsuit, is that also something you're thinking about where you do the lawsuit?
So let me first say, when North Carolina repeals its income tax, I hope you'll reconsider coming
right?
to Asheville.
Or Canada.
I think it would be highly unlikely that they did what we call forum shopping in the law.
Okay.
They shopped around for the state with the best laws.
Okay. It has a name, so it is a thing.
Sometimes that term forum shopping is used disparagingly, and I don't mean it in that way, but that's a little bit what happened in Natalie's case, in my opinion, is she found the venue that was likely to be most advantageous for her. There's nothing wrong with that. A lot of companies get formed in the state of Delaware, even if they're not located there. And there are reasons for that I'm happy to go into if you want. But I don't think that's what happened here. What I meant by the home field advantage comment is companies or parties to a contract, they tend to want the dispute resolution to be in the state where they're located because, look, having to travel to a whole other state in order to carry out a lawsuit, it's expensive. It's a huge headache. As opposed to being able to just go home and sleep in your own bed at night and eat at the restaurant you already
yeah,
know about and
sense.
See your friends and family and all this kind of stuff. So that's what's going on there, I think.
That makes sense. Based on the time that we recorded this, the Prodigy versus Gannon trial, one of which had already happened, they already went to trial. And so was Gannon required to be present or some legal representation required to be present? Or does Prodigy kind of get the benefit in that, hey, he's at the All-Stars event. He's not even here. He doesn't care about this. We're here and we're ready to fight this. And hey, we're from Georgia. Does that make them look better and have a better case of winning?
You know, I think if you asked a Georgia court judge, when parties come before you, are you able to be fair and impartial and not give any sort of advantage depending on where the person is from? The judge would say, absolutely, of course. We all kind of know that maybe at least in some cases, if the party in front of you has maybe a similar accent to you, or maybe their cousin goes to church with you or something like that, you know, does that maybe give a subtle edge? I think it can. I think that's part of what is behind that. Relative to what's already happened at the time that we're recording this, in Gannon's case, yeah, Prodigy did go to court and ask for an injunction. They wanted to ask the court to force Gannon to comply with his contract until the underlying lawsuit was able to be resolved. And when you have an emergency hearing like that, it's called a temporary restraining order. Those emergency hearings, they actually can take place in some cases without the presence of the other party. It wasn't granted in Gannon's case, and a lot of times it is very difficult to get them to be granted, in part because the other party isn't there to defend itself. I actually don't know if Gannon had a representative there at that hearing or not. Certainly, if Gannon's case goes to trial or went to trial, I would expect he probably would be there in person with his counsel.
Wow. Okay.
Wow. So this is our last question for you, Chris, and thank you again so much for coming on and really educating us all on disc golf law, like everything that goes on that we would need to know in disc golf. So thank you so much for that.
It was my pleasure.
Yeah. Do you think lawsuits are going to be more regular in the future, in the next decade, let's say, in disc golf?
In disc golf, I would say yes. And I hope I'm wrong, but it's just simply because of the fact that the dollars continue to grow. And it's very difficult in our court system. If you have a monetary dispute below a certain amount of money, like I'm just going to make this up, but let's say you've got a dispute with somebody over $25,000. Like, to me, that's a very significant amount of money. Right. And I think to most people it is. There's just no reasonable scenario where it makes sense for you to go hire a lawyer and sue somebody for that amount of money, because you're probably going to end up paying more in legal fees than you stand to recover. Right. And I think that's a shortcoming of our legal system. So when the dollar amounts are small, you have relatively few lawsuits filed. But as they do continue to grow, unfortunately, sometimes people just can't work out their differences. And I think we will see more, but not that that's what I want to happen. I just think that's the reality.
Just the reality.
Yeah. That's, I mean, fair. As the sport is growing, and this is something that we're all talking about, grow the sport, you know, that comes more problems, unfortunately, yeah. and legal battles. So yeah, I think the last thing, and just to give you a chance to kind of, you know, shout out your company, how people can get in touch with you. You said 25,000, which does seem significant to all of us here, but it's not in court of law. How can someone get in touch with you and just have a setup call where it's like, hey, I have this thing, this is the dollar amount, and is it worth going to court? How can someone get a hold of you and discuss something over the phone, whether or not they want you to be their lawyer or just to get some counsel or some advice? How can they reach out to you and your team?
I won't say that what I'm about to describe is necessarily free advice. It really isn't. But on our social channels, particularly on YouTube, discgolf.law on YouTube, we do regularly release videos on issues that are hopefully of interest to people in disc golf. So even without contacting us and speaking to us directly, there's a lot, in my opinion, that you can learn from that. But always welcome to email us info@discgolf.law. And, you know, we can set up a consultation. I'll tell you, and if this wasn't readily apparent from this podcast, I'll just frankly come out and say it. If you have a dispute with someone else, it's likely that I'm going to advise a dozen other things before we get to the point of trying to file a lawsuit.
Absolutely.
I'm a mediator. I'm an arbitrator. I'm a big fan of alternate forms of dispute resolution. I think we're pretty good at negotiating and things like that. But perhaps more appropriately, if you've got a new disc golf business, if you're looking at a contract, if you're, you know, considering some intellectual property protection, you know, those are the kinds of things that we would really love to work with you on. And if you'll indulge me, one more thing that I would like to say: when I'm not wearing my discgolf.law hat, I am the executive director of the Ulibarri Leadership Foundation. And so I would also encourage everybody to go to uli.foundation and be generous.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Chris. And definitely everyone check out those two links for sure. We'll drop them in the description below as well. Chris, thank you so much. I think Joe and I have a lot to think about and talk about off air. This definitely has been an absolute pleasure having you on here and educating us and the listeners. And I hope to meet you in person and continue some conversations about all things disc golf.
Assuming the OTB Open happens, we will be there. We'll be in Portland. We'll be at Ledgestone. So hopefully we'll have an opportunity
Amazing.
To do that.
Amazing.
Awesome. We'll see you there then. Thank you so much
all
again,
right,
Chris.
Great. My pleasure. It was an honor.
Oh my goodness. I feel like I just learned so much, Paige. That was incredible. Like,
yes, it was.
Oh my goodness.
Also, there's a lot of words that I need to go Google now.
Right?
That I'm like just nodding my head like, oh yeah,
I know. Yeah, I know what that means. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to go Google that.
Send him an email right after this. Yeah. Can
it's
you clarify?
Great because like we said, like he isn't our typical guest, right? He isn't someone that all of our listeners might need to go call or look up his Instagram or email him, but he is approachable in himself. You know, mm-hmm. if you're talking about lawyers, like he's as approachable as they come. And he just seems like the type of guy that you could just go out and play a disc golf round with him and never even know he's a lawyer. But I found his interview to be so insightful and something that really got my brain just going. So I hope it did the same for you guys listening at home.
I loved that he said that he wanted to challenge our mindset. Like multiple times he used that phrase. And he kept on saying things like breaking a contract doesn't have to be a bad thing. Like there's a lot of learning that goes on in that. And honestly, I feel like it's just one of those things that sometimes it does benefit the person to break a contract. Sometimes in some regards. But yeah, there were just so many times where I felt like his attitude and his perception and his mindset just really, really felt very positive and very approachable, like you said, Paige.
Yeah, and just having someone, whether or not you actually need it in the long run, having someone that you can talk to and just bounce ideas off of or say, hey, is this going to be a problem? Am I okay? Is this in my best interest? That could also just be so beneficial. And like he said, his team are there to help their clients avoid costly mistakes and set them up for success. So I think that just contacting them at discgolf.law or to go drop down to our description, we linked some ways to get in touch with him. It's worth a conversation. Like he said, he has a YouTube channel that has so many different tips on it. I've watched a few of his YouTube videos and found them very entertaining, even though there's no B-roll, there's no putts going in the basket, right. But he's giving you information that is relevant now and is going to be even more relevant in the years to come in disc golf as the sport is growing.
Yeah, so go get in touch with him and be sure to look out for the next episode as well. And if you have any comments, questions, or concerns, you can also head over to your email and you can email approachable@jomezpro.com. And we would love to hear from you and maybe you can even give us a new idea for our next guest.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye-bye. Thanks for tuning into Approachable, presented by Grip Equipment, empowered by Jomez Pro.